Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I want him to know that I understand the things that he went through. But I just want him to know that for the things that have happened, I still love him.
Sir, what if the writer is attempting to create a story where nothing much happens, where people don't change? More reflection of the real world.
Nothing happens in the world? Are you out of your fucking mind?
Welcome back to A Theory of Mind, a podcast about brains, minds, and the lived-in experience of change from your host, me, author and biographer, Ben McKelvey. We've got a great interview today with former UFC fighter James Tahuna. He's someone who's overcome real physical and emotional trauma to become a very happy and settled bloke, and you'll hear from James in a couple of minutes. But first, I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you all for listening. I've loved doing these interviews. I had no idea what the response was going to be when they were published, but it's been overwhelmingly great. I love that you're listening. I love that you're contacting me about the show, suggesting guests, or just saying that you like the show. It's all been really gratifying, so I just wanted to take this moment and say thank you. Okay, so James Tahuna. James is an athlete. Formerly, he was one of Australasia's most venerated fighters, and currently he's one of Australia's best stone lifters. We talk about James's UFC rise and also his fall, which happened when he started to lose his chin. It's a common term in combat sports, losing your chin, and essentially it means that the fighter can be knocked out more easily. This actually has nothing to do with the chin, and of course, everything to do with the brain. We do get into brain damage here a little bit, but we also talk about the positive and redemptive nature of martial arts. James tells the story of being an abused and bullied child who became a confident and fully realised man through the vehicle of martial arts. As always, if you want to contact the show, and I love when you do, find me on Facebook or at my Instagram, at Benny Merck, BennyMck. And without further ado, James Tahuna. So, James, I did want to get into your fighting career and the end of your fighting career. But we've spoken previously about the circumstances which you grew up in and your dad, who is a great mate of yours now, but someone who has had a few troubles himself. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about your upbringing, about your memories of your childhood and whatever you want to share?
Yep. I was born and bred in New Zealand, a small country town's. And had some experiences growing up that affected me.
Yeah,
my brother, and so my father, it was my father was he experienced heavily traumatized when he was 12 years old, and that carried on through his a few years in his life, and I got to experience
a bit of that.
Yeah.
Did you know then that he was suffering through trauma, or did you just sort of think that he was just angry?
Oh, at the time I was just trying to this is it, this is what it is, and got to learn how to deal with it, manage it better.
Yeah.
So we quickly had to learn
on the fly.
Yeah.
You and Tama. So is Tama older than you or younger?
Yeah, Tama's 4 years older than me.
Yeah. So. Did you guys sit down and talk about coping strategies? You're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it.
No, we were just aware of what was working and what wasn't. Okay, we won't do that again. Maybe we'll do this.
I just see an image of the two of you just sitting there bedraggled and bleeding, and you're like, all right, we fucked up.
Yeah, we quickly learn.
So what was... Do you think? I mean, you know, you're in a unique position that you and your dad have a good relationship now. That's still true.
Yeah.
And so presumably you can go back and talk about what was going on at that time. Do you have a relationship where you will do that?
Yeah, we kind of like we don't dive into it, but we kind of like talk about certain things that have happened and still. Then my dad likes to joke a lot. he always throws jokes around and he won't say go into detail about things that happened, but then he'll end it like he'll end it with a joke or a laugh or something to like, you know.
To diffuse the situation.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that you told me was really grim. But does he even remember all that stuff in his moments of extreme trauma?
I'm not too sure.
Yeah,
I'm not too sure. I don't know if he's just buried it.
Because it does seem to me, the way that you sort of described it to me, is that he would go to another place. So it's, you know, it's entirely possible now that he doesn't remember all of it.
I like to talk about it with him, but I'm not too sure if he would cope.
Yeah,
I think I don't know how to enter that conversation.
Yeah. And what is the instinct then to go and talk to him about it? You know, you're in a good place now, you and Tama. So why do you think that that's something that you would like to do?
I would just like to. I think. For him, I think he's regretting a lot, and I want him to know that I understand and understand like the things that he went through, and not fully understand. I mean, there'll be a lot that I don't know, but I just want him to know that for the things that have happened, I still love him.
So. How did you get a sense of the fact that something had happened to him when he was 12? Was this something that he came and spoke to you later on, or how did you know?
It was just through talk through the family. Yep. Over the years.
Other family members who knew that something had happened to him. When did you find that out?
Always kind of was aware of it as a teenager, but then in my 20s and then 30s, started talking about it more, keeping my ears kind of open about, you know, and discussing it more. Yeah.
Now, when you were a young man, you were a pretty shy guy, right? I mean, you're still pretty shy.
Yeah.
But you were very shy. Is that part of the reason that you ended up doing martial arts? Is it to give you confidence?
Yeah. Yeah. I knew the state that I was in. As a kid, like shy, timid, was a target for bullying.
Yeah, right.
Just, you know, always if there was like a conflict or confrontation or something, I would just curl up into my shell and just not want to, just want to disappear. So, yeah.
What age was this? Sort of like 10, 12?
From as early I can remember, like probably 5 years old, 6 years old.
Hmm.
Yeah, I remember being 5 or 6, being at school and just not wanting to participate because I was afraid of
confrontation.
Yeah, confrontation or just someone asking me a question I didn't want to be there. I just want to be on the outside, just watching and listening and learning.
So you had real confidence issues.
Yeah.
Yep. About everything.
Yep.
Yeah. But you're a great athlete. I mean, you're an amazing athlete. So surely that must have manifested itself at some point in high school and you would have got some cachet. I mean,
yeah, it definitely picked up my confidence. I learning martial arts for me was just a vehicle. I knew that was going to give me strength where I needed it.
Tama did it before you?
Myself and Tama had done it at the same time.
Yeah, right. Yep. So where did you go? What was the first martial arts that you did?
So I think Dad took us to karate when we were like kids. And I think we'd done one or two sessions and it was never, we didn't continue going on for whatever reason. But we moved to another town in the South Island and there was a boxing gym there. And then Dad started getting involved and took us all down there and met the coach. And we felt a part of this kind of click. Like it was like an old gym that had been there for a long time, but it was rebuilding again with, you know, a couple of members in the community, and they wanted to be a part of something and brought us two boys along. And
so he was training as well?
Yeah, he was coaching as well. He just wanted to be involved. Yeah.
Did he have a history of combat sports?
No. It was just out on the street.
He had some unofficial experience.
Yeah, unofficial experience.
Yeah. So in this boxing gym, you found a little community, you know, you found these people that you want to spend more time with, you know, and it's a culture that has persisted through your life. I mean, that's probably true now of you know, you're still doing jiu-jitsu, right?
No, actually, I wanted to do it, but my body can't really.
Ah, right.
See, it's saying different things now, so.
But tell us a little bit about those early fights and the confidence that it sort of gave you.
A huge boost for me. So I was 12 or 13 years old when I started training.
Yeah.
The boxing training is quite hard, and it's you know, you walk into like a hostile environment and you don't know what can happen.
There's nowhere to run.
Yeah, well, like you got to get your shit sorted, otherwise you can get seriously hurt.
Yeah.
And I knew the state that I was in and what I needed. And I was a very slow learner. I knew that I was a slow learner. I knew I had to do something about that. So I was there putting probably, you know, when it would take a kid like maybe half an hour to learn a technique, it would take me like several hours.
Mm.
But I'll also put in those several hours to learn that technique.
Why did you want to do it? I mean, it sounds like at school at that time, you were sort of shying away from everything. And I can imagine there would have been a part of you, the instinct would have been just to go away and not do it, not be bad at it.
Yeah.
What kept you there? Was it your dad and your brother?
I was, yes, yep. My dad, my brother, because, I mean, if they went elsewhere, then I probably wouldn't have went.
Mm.
So they helped with that. And for me to actually stay in there and want to carry on doing it, it was, I always knew that I was capable of something and had a lot of faith. And
all through your childhood, even though you had this real confidence issue, you felt like you were going to be something.
Yeah, yeah, I felt like I was capable of more than just this.
Yeah,
because I knew the person that I was, and I was like, I know I can be, you know, I know I can do things, be great at doing things.
You're like, there'll be something.
Yeah, to be something, I'm pretty aware of like where I am now. How do I get there? What do I need to do?
Mm.
And I guess, you know, watching TV, role models on TV and seeing them, what they've done to be successful. Okay, well, that's it. That's what I need to do.
Yeah. And so how did you migrate from boxing into mixed martial arts?
Moved over to Australia when I was 17. And my brother came across these UFC fighting tapes, mixed martial arts fighting tapes at the markets. So we bought them.
So sorry, just before we go forward, why did you and your brother decide to come to Australia? Just for a change of scenery or?
Yeah, so Tama came over here a year earlier and mum and dad decided to make the move because we were kind of a tight family too. So.
Oh, so Tama came over first and then the family came over. Yeah, right.
Yeah, Tama's always been kind of the leader of the family and you know, he goes off and does his own thing and we kind of, you know, we're very tight with one another and so we followed. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Tama had found these tapes and he's like, oh, this is going to be us.
Yeah, well, like I guess, you know, growing up and watching these blood sport movies and American Kickboxer and so on, we were like, yeah, pretty surprised that this was actually a competition and it was, you know, eventually it was becoming legal.
It was kumite.
Yeah, kumite. It was exciting, one style versus another style.
Yeah.
It was definitely exciting and it was something that I was attracted to.
And so what did you guys just look at the tapes and go, okay, who's doing well? Hoist Gracie's doing well. What do we need to do?
Yeah,
jiu-jitsu. Is that how it worked?
Yep, that's how it worked. You know, he's wearing a gi. We need to learn jiu-jitsu. Where can we find jiu-jitsu? It took us maybe a few months to find someone in the area that was teaching jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
In that time, though, in the few months we were trying to find somewhere. We'll lay out a blanket out in the grass on the lawn.
Just teaching yourself.
Yeah,
just like watching the old tapes.
We're just watching the old tapes and
were you wearing dressing gowns? Because you wouldn't have been able to find geese.
And no clothes. And long clothes, pants and jumpers.
Yeah.
But just learning what just copying the stuff that the fighters were winning fights with.
Yeah. And just like doing it over and over again. Yeah, going, okay, where was this guy's leg? Where was this guy's arm? Yeah. That's amazing.
But I think one of the biggest things that helped us out was using our Our mind too. So imagining and what do you call it when you visualization. Yeah. I was just visualizing exactly how that move was, you know, executed.
Yeah.
Because I replayed that tape, rewinded that tape over and over and over and over again. So it was so in my head.
Don't fear the man with the 10,000 techniques. Fear the man that's done one technique 10,000 times.
Yeah.
So who did you find? Because this intersects with Mark Hunt's story, because I remember when I was doing the book with him, he came to Sydney and he was a kickboxer, but he had, you know, no experience with jiu-jitsu. And he actually ended up training with you guys. He ended up finding you guys. But presumably you guys had found someone to train you before then.
Yep. So 2004, I was training with John Pedro, and John Pedro was also
Tyson's dad?
Tyson's dad, yeah. And Tyson was only like a little kid. I think he was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
And he was training with us.
Yeah.
Doing quite well, very talented. So John Pedro was also associated with Marcelo Mizende, who was one of three Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belts at the time in Sydney. And
so how did you find these guys?
So I found Pedro, and then Pedro found Marcelo.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Pedro organized that, and then we went across to Manly and created a relationship there. And Marcelo asked one weekend if I could rock up and help train with this big guy, big heavyweight.
Yeah.
Okay, well, a big guy, you know, I'll be able to gain a few things, get a bit stronger, training with a big body. And there's Mark Hunt as I walk out to the gym. He's warming up, doing laps around the mat, and I'm like, oh, wow. I would have known Mark from the K1 days.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So I'm spinning out.
He'd already won the K1, right?
Yeah. So I'm buzzing, and then, Mark being Mark goes, hey, man, what's up? And hey, hey. So I'm trying to play it cool, and then we just started training and built that relationship from there.
Yeah. What was he like then? You know, his training ethic wasn't particularly good. You know, if anyone who's read the book knows at the time, he was sort of hot and cold a little bit.
Yeah. When we trained, it was good training.
On. Yeah.
Yep, it was on.
Yeah.
You can't really comment on or judge what he'd done outside of that. Yeah. I just don't know.
Yeah. Before you went to the UFC, you were fighting here in Australia for AFC, was that right? Or CFC maybe?
CFC.
Yeah. So how did tell me about the early fights that you had and your experiences with a crowd?
That was awesome. I was at that stage I was just becoming obsessed with mixed martial arts, MMA, fighting, and I was working as a brickies laborer at the time. So I worked 5 days a week, and then everything around that, I would train in the morning before I went to work, and then train straight after work. And being so obsessed, I just put so much time and effort into it. Loved it.
This was always with a view to competing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I met Mark, and then Mark, we built that relationship, and Mark brought me over to one of his fights in Pride. And I just was exposed to this mixed martial arts world of how big it was. Didn't realize it. I thought it was just, you know, UFC and that was it. Then experienced that Pride experience in Japan. It was huge.
Was it one of the like massive ones, 50,000 people, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, something like that. It was it was awesome.
Yeah.
Really good experience. And Mark gave me that opportunity and just really opened up my eyes. And I thought, you know what? He's a Polynesian that's, you know, had rough upbringings, and he puts in the work. So. Mm. You know, maybe if I put in a bit more work and slug it out, I'll be able to get there too.
Mm.
So, he definitely inspired me to push a bit harder.
So Pride was the place where you thought you would go, which incidentally, Pride and K1, a lot of Polynesian Kiwis had ended up fighting in Pride and K1. There was Clay Amatagi, is that right?
Yeah, Clay, yeah.
Yeah, and his brother, I think, maybe fought as well, or his cousin. And then there was Ray Sefu, obviously. So there was a little bit of a path being beaten.
Yep. It's taken my mind back a fair bit now. It was also a time where I just had my tunnel vision on.
Yeah, yeah, of course. It was your career.
So everything around me was like, yeah, I wasn't too really taking notice.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, it would have been amazing, and it was amazing for Mark as well, you know, fighting in Australia, you know, a couple of hundred people, you know, there was a bit of a scene, and then going to Japan and just seeing 50,000 people. It was the biggest thing on television there at the time as well. All of the huge international superstars were there, so it would have been a transformative moment.
Yeah, it was just, yeah, it was huge for me because, I mean, going back to when I was a kid, being as afraid of confrontation, and then stepping in the ring for my very first fight when I was 14 years old.
Mm.
So for me to do that when I was 14 years old, I was shit scared of everything.
Yeah.
And then I get matched up on this card in deep in the South Island called Invercargill, this place in the bottom of New Zealand.
Yeah.
And it's at an army base. So it's at an army base, and we walk out to the ring, and there's a ring in the middle of like a hangar. And all the audience is probably like, I don't know, say a couple of hundred, you know, guys there. They're all like part of the infantry, yeah, dressed in uniform. Yeah. So I'm walking out, and they're looking at me as I'm walking out. Oh, man.
And you're a 14-year-old kid?
Yeah, I'm only just like a little scaredy cat kid.
Were you fighting another kid or were you fighting a man?
Yeah, no, I was fighting another kid a year older than me, I think. He had ring experience, one or two fights or something, maybe. I can't remember. But I get into that ring and I'm like, oh no, this is, I'm going to die. But the bell went and we started boxing. At the end of the fight, he was declared the winner. Lots of punches were thrown, not by me.
Yeah.
lots of punches didn't land. I think I got out of the ring without a punch being landed, so yeah, I was happy. But I didn't get discouraged from that fight. I thought, okay, well, it's...
Yeah. You're like, if that's the worst thing that can happen, you know, like I can do this again.
Yeah, I can do this again.
I can calm down a little bit as well and enjoy
it. Yeah, yeah. I just thought myself as, okay, well, I'm getting stronger. I'm better than what I was yesterday. So just keep that ball rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you ended up fighting internationally. Was the UFC the first place where you fought with a big organization? Did you fight with Pride?
No. Was about to. Mark actually got me a one-fight contract, like a trial fight.
Yeah.
And then UFC bought out Pride and that happened and that was it.
Did you migrate from that one fight? Some of the Pride contracts were acknowledged. Yeah. Was yours acknowledged?
Did that migrate? No, I wasn't. But it wasn't until maybe like a year or two later, I just kept on pushing. Okay, well, UFC.
Because you fought a couple of the UFC guys outside of the UFC. You fought Anthony Perosh, right?
Yeah.
Before you fought in the UFC.
Yeah.
And maybe Hector Lombard as well, or no?
He was fighting in Japan.
Right.
He was fighting in Japan. But, I was racking up fights and there was rumour of UFC coming to Sydney, Australia. And I thought, okay, well, it's coming in the following year. So maybe this year, if I really work hard and get some notches under my belt and get some wins happening and just train hard and build my name, I'll be able to get an undercard or, you know, people will be like aware of me.
Yeah.
So I quit my job, borrowed some money, took a gamble, trained full time, and then won that first fight. And then, okay, paid everyone back for the money.
This was your first UFC fight? You did get on UFC 110?
No, this is to get there.
Oh, this is to get in there. Yeah.
So then, paid everyone back in the next fight, done the same thing, borrowed money so I can train full time, pay everyone back, and then... got on roll, then got offered a contract to fight in the UFC, being a local boy.
This was 110?
110, yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And then...
who did you fight?
A guy called Igor Prokryak.
Oh, I remember Igor Prokryak. Didn't they call him the janitor?
Or something like that. Wasn't that guy. He was... I forgot what they called him. He was a tough dude.
Yeah. There were some amazing fighters, even though there wasn't a title fight for that UFC 110. I was following George Soteropoulos round for a story. You know, meeting all the fighters. It was actually an amazing event. Mark was actually on the undercard because he was on the outs with the UFC.
Yeah.
Cain Velasquez was up fighting Bigfoot, right? For the main event.
Nogueira.
Yeah.
That's an old one. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, right. So what was the experience like? Because I was there in the stadium and it was just electric from my perspective. It must have been incredible for you.
Yeah, it was, well, to be honest, I was the first fighter on the undercard.
Yeah, so everyone was having coffee and bacon and eggs.
Yeah, well, like, you know, a UFC card will go from first fight to the last fight, will go for like, I don't know, say 5 hours or something. Yeah. Long time, right? From the first fight to the last fight. It's only the main event card that has like four fights or five fights or whatever that actually most people see on TV. But anyway, the whole card's a long time. So I thought, okay, first fight in the card, it's going to be like probably not even a quarter of it filled by then. And then curtains pulled back, and then the lights come on, and then shit, every single head is sitting in their seat. I've just had my head down. I'm like, oh no. Walked out there, and then.
And it probably would have been 11 o'clock in the morning, right?
Yeah, 11 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Not that the time made a difference for me. I was ready to go anytime.
Yeah.
But just walking out there, experiencing that, and then
did you let yourself enjoy it, or just duck your head down and just sort of walk to the
duck my head down and just like a mixed set of emotions. Yeah, I was thriving on that. Next minute, oh no, and then oh shit, who's that? Oh, I can spot thingy over there, and
you're seeing your friends and stuff.
Yeah,
like
and then, oh man, it was pretty crazy, but it was an awesome experience.
Yeah,
and again, like when I. Go back to that time when I experienced that. It just throws me back to when I was a kid too, like knowing that what state I was in and the reasons why I started martial arts.
So you did feel a sense of pride that you were like, I felt like I was going to be someone, and I am. You know, people are cheering, people are loving this.
Yeah, yeah. I just had that, a lot of pride.
Yeah.
And it took many years to build this pride.
Yeah. Now, you had an incredible run at the UFC. And you actually ended up headlining. Did you not headline the first New Zealand UFC event?
I headlined the first New Zealand.
Yep. And was that the event where you did the Men in Black walkout?
No, there was another event prior to that. But, the Men in Black one was pretty special too.
Yeah, you got to tell us that because it's like, from being a kid that's like, oh, I just want to be in the periphery and not to be seen to doing one of the most ostentatious walkouts in UFC history.
Well, I still was like in that state of mind, like I knew I was capable of something and like I was a part of the UFC roster.
Yeah.
How many fighters on the UFC roster? Maybe a couple of hundred or something.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm still capable of more than just like another person in the roster. I know, So I wanted to go out there and shine and do something good and do something fun. And at the time too was some of my teammates went, we were arguing and the whole crew, so I had to bring up the morale bring the culture back and build it up again, make it strong. So that Men in Black
I love dance. The idea of like arguing with your team members over something and then going, okay, the way we're going to bring this together is we're going to do a uniform dance as we walk out to the octagon at a UFC event.
It was quite funny because we were actually, there was a team of six of us, or five or six of us, and we're over in London. So we're over there trying to acclimatise. We're there for 2 weeks before the fight. We're there for 2 weeks. We're staying at the same house. We're training with each other. So five, six alpha dudes, like, around each other 24/7 doesn't work.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the arguments and the fights happened. One of my mates who came with me, we were talking about entrances, and I was like, oh, yeah, it was always something that I'd love to do because I love Pride so much, and Pride had the biggest entrances. And then I think I come up with the idea of, love Will Smith, Men in Black, would be cool to walk out. How would you go if, how would you like the idea if we all walked out? Kind of toss it up like a joke.
Yeah.
But really, I was serious.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, that'll be cool. And I was like, okay, well, that's a green light for me.
Oh, it was amazing. It was.
Do you reckon we should do it? Yeah. All right. So we.
It was the best.
Yeah.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I was wondering whether it was because you had gone to one of those Pride events, because those Pride intros, you know, the screaming woman and the taiko drums and, you know, like it was amazing to see that stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was very, very special. Mark brought me over a couple of times and I got to experience the opening of Pride.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, just like goosebumps right through your whole body. It was very something very, very different than it probably I won't expect in a while, you know, be able to experience in a long time, I think.
I mean, I think the biggest Pride event was 110,000 people, and it's actually on YouTube when you can see the opening of that event. I think it's like Pride 15 or something like that, and everybody's up on this scaffold. Mark's there, and it's Vandalay Silver and Mikko Krokop and stuff like that, and it has this grandeur, you know, like the UFC is a bigger money spinner now than it was then, but that is where MMA peaked. I mean, that was an incredible era.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I did want to talk to you about was, you know, you were having these arguments with these people. You were at the top of your game. You know, you were headlining cards. But the money wasn't necessarily what other people perceived. You know, the UFC has tight purse strings. Except for the absolute uber superstars, it's, you know, Mark had an incredible contract or a couple of incredible contracts. But for other people, did you have to maintain a job when you were still a sort of a UFC star?
I was fortunate enough to have sponsors.
Yeah. But so, outside of that, you would have had to
outside of
that,
yeah, I would have, yeah. Outside of not having any sponsors, I would have to work a full-time job.
That is not something that people, UFC anyway. That people think.
I do know that the majority of the fighters that were, you know, trying to get the next fight or trying to get the next pay packet, that weren't in a top position.
Mm.
A lot of fighters living as hippies day to day, trying to survive till the next pay packet.
With UFC careers, and this is quite often the case with UFC careers, they're great until they're not. you had a submission loss, I believe, to Glover Teixeira, and then you were on the same card as Mark when he was fighting Bigfoot, and you got knocked out by Shogun, and it was a little left hook. It was a sort of punch that you would have taken many, many times in your career and wouldn't have knocked you out.
Yeah.
Were you at that stage at a place where you were sort of susceptible to punches, and you would have known this in training? When you had the Shogun fight, you know, were you a bit fragile then?
Yeah, I was. I actually noticed this when I fought Glover Teixeira and I lost by submission, and then I had the Shogun fight coming up. So during that training preparation, I noticed that something was happening.
That was the first time?
Yeah, during that preparation, during that camp, yeah. Mm.
So tell me about what happened. Tell me about the way that it manifested itself.
I was sparring Tyson Pedro.
Mm.
And Tyson Pedro was
a kid at the time, I'd imagine.
Yeah, pretty much. And he was also wanting to compete in MMA. I think he had one or two fights, not even.
Mm.
And he rocked me. And I was like, buckled my legs. I was doing a chicken dance and then got back up and then tried to tough it out and keep on battling and then finish that sparring session. But then after that, I'm thinking, fuck.
Well, you're laughing about it now, but I can imagine at the time it would have been pretty fucking terrifying, not only because, you know, there was something going on with your brain, but also because this was your bread and butter, this was your career, and this was your dream.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, if this kid is giving me the chicken dance, like, what's going on?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I just thought, oh, yeah, every time I train with Tyson now, I'm going to make sure I have my hands up because he's very good.
Is that what you thought initially, just that Tyson had super heavy hands? You didn't know that something was
like,
going
I
on
I just
with
thought,
you?
You know, the status that I was at, being in the UFC, I was like, yeah, sweet, I'm good, I've got skills. And then Tyson comes out, ba-bang, and I'm oh, fuck. He fucking brought me down to earth real quick.
Yeah. But what, I mean, no one knows actually what was going on, but there was something going on in your brain that was sort of turning off the lights a little bit quicker than it should have.
Yeah.
So did that keep going through training, and were you having other effects? You know, were you becoming susceptible to light? Were you getting headaches? What was going on?
From that point on, when I was, you know, when that happened, I it wasn't too noticeable, but like further on preparing for different fights and sparring and training practice, I'll get rocked probably more times than I should have, than I would have before. Yeah.
And so did anyone ever talk to you about that, or did you talk to anyone else about it, or was that kind of a taboo?
No, I was just like, shake it off and just make sure that you work on your defense and make you know, so it doesn't happen again.
Did you get a sense that things were changing in your career? I mean, you had an incredible chin, and now all of a sudden it was getting a bit wonky.
Yeah, well, I guess copping losses and then getting rocked, and then I guess my started becoming a little bit more emotional. And
did it manifest itself as a lack of confidence rather than recognizing that physiological something had changed?
Yeah, my confidence was definitely dropping.
Mm.
And
when you watch that Shogun Hua fight, or when you watched it back after experiencing it, did you look at it and go, "What's going on? That probably shouldn't have knocked me out."
Yeah, I it was only like a small tap.
Mm.
And I was thinking, far out, I'm pretty sure I've been hit with bigger strikes. And, you know, it was only a couple of fights ago where I got head kicked in a temple and then dropped and stood back up and went again and fought the rest of the whole fight. But that one, it was just a small little tap.
Mm.
I thought, oh, okay, well, dropped my confidence. I got to, try and pick up my confidence back up and work on my weaknesses and
so you
my
didn't,
defense. And,
you didn't recognize that your brain was changing?
No,
I at didn't.
No.
Is that something that fighters don't talk about? You know, because it is pretty common for guys, as they have a lot of fights, sometimes their chin will just go,
you know?
But it's not something that people talk about?
Oh, back when I was competing, it was, not really. It wasn't really talked about.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was. I just wasn't, I didn't have my ears open to it.
Yeah.
Not as much as what it has been now.
Mm.
I don't know if it's been talked about. Well, it has been talked about a lot now, and I'll pick up on everything about CTE and concussions and
But not then.
Mm.
So you had the fight with Shogun, and I think Steve Bossy was the next fight after that.
Yep. I think. I can't remember.
When you walked into that fight and when you were training in the lead up to that fight, were you a little bit fearful? You know, did you think, oh, fuck, I might walk out and I might get hit with something that's not particularly hard and, I might end up on the floor here?
During that preparation, no, not really.
Yeah.
It didn't really come to my mind. I just thought, Steve Bosse, he's a new guy in the UFC.
Yeah.
He's not a fighter. He's an ice hockey player. He comes from, many years of playing ice hockey. Then I've been fighting combat sports for 18 years or something.
Yeah, because you look at your career and you look at Steve Bossy and you go, oh, the UFC gave you a nice easy one.
Yeah,
they wanted to boost your confidence. They wanted to build your name back up again.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like.
Yeah, I've always been against fighting people that have had less experience than me. You've always aimed for the top. A lot of people always said, oh, Tahuna could have been a great fighter, but he got fed to the sharks straight away too early. UFC didn't play him a good card.
You could have been a great fighter. You were a great fighter.
Oh, man, I just, all those people that I asked for, Shogun and Tashira, I put my hand up for them.
Yeah, yeah.
I was straight in there. I wanted the challenge. That's what I want. I love challenges.
That's the best thing about it.
Yeah. And
you got this Bossy fight.
Yeah, they're giving me that guy, and I was like, oh. But then I'm kind of on a downward spiral too, so maybe I need to I've got to pick up my confidence a bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I took that fight.
Did you have any conversations with the matchmakers, Joe Silver or whoever, about why you were getting this Steve Bossy fight?
No, I just out with my manager.
Yeah, they just offered it to you and you had to think about it and you were like, yeah, okay, I'll do it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
When you were training, were you also getting some chicken dance issues and, were there any other neurological issues when you were training for that fight that you were aware of?
Yeah, yeah.
What sort of stuff?
Yeah, a couple of more knocks and
like what?
During training.
So just experiences where you'd cop a couple of strikes and then you'd be knocked out or chicken
dance?
Oh,
no, rocked.
Yeah.
And just seeing stars and stuff. So I guess that camp too, I actually started using headgear more often.
And so what did your trainer think about that? all the people around you in your camp or your brother, did anyone recognise that something else was going on? Did anyone try and sit down and have a chat with you and go, are you all right? What's going on?
Oh, no, not really. No, yeah. No, because I was like the captain of my ship.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, they all just go like, oh, yeah. They probably had a lot of things to say to me.
Yeah.
But they didn't because they didn't want to plant something in my head, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Plant something else, so like lose. Yeah, they're probably afraid of me dropping my confidence or something. Or
yeah.
And
so you get out in this bossy fight, and I think it was probably only a minute in the first round, right? Where he caught you again with a little left hook from memory.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the Shogun Hua punch was relatively insignificant. This one, there's no way that it should have dropped you. So, tell me about what happened after that fight.
So you got taken back, backstage, got looked at, you know, eyes checked and everything by the doc, and then got sent to hospital.
Mm.
And,
why was that?
I got sent to hospital because it was, because I'd been badly knocked out and, to get my, brain scanned.
But there must have been some other effects because people get, you know, people get knocked out all the time and then they sort of bounce back and they seem to be okay and they don't get transported to hospital. There must have been some sort of lingering effect, something that the doctor saw that he didn't like.
Yeah, so the doctor saw a bunch of lesions on the brain.
This is when you got the scan.
Yeah.
But the doctor at the the event must have seen something. Yeah, must have been something in your eyes or you having memory problems or what was going on?
I'm not too sure. I can't remember.
Yeah, right. So it's entirely possible that he asked you what your name was. You might not have got it right or something.
Yeah,
like
I could
that.
Have yeah, yeah. answered like another question, given a wrong answer. But
yeah,
it could have been that's why I've got sent off. But yeah, I would have thought that. I wonder if most fighters, when they do suffer KO loss, do they get sent to get brain scanned? They only just get assist.
Yeah,
backstage.
It's only if the doctor looks at your pupils, asks you a couple of questions, and then thinks that there might be ongoing issues, as there was with you.
Oh, yeah. So they see me. Yeah. Okay.
So there must have been something going on.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That you must have either seemed discombobulated or couldn't answer the doctor's questions or something like that.
Yeah.
So they transport you to hospital and you get a brain scan, which is presumably the first time that it's happened to you.
Yeah.
And what were your feelings like then? You must have been bummed out. You'd had this loss that you didn't think you were going to have, plus you've ended up in hospital, plus you're getting this brain scan.
So had all this pride built up for so many years.
Mm.
Since I was a little kid, so I started this journey to, you know, give myself some pride, some self-esteem and confidence that I was lacking when I was a kid. And had built this up for so many years and then crushed. I felt like I had it all crushed all in one night. I was like, oh, man, I just felt that small.
Yeah.
It felt worthless.
And when they told you that there were some lesions on your brain, I can imagine that would have been even more devastating because you're like, I've lost this pride, plus I might have these sort of ongoing issues.
Yeah, well, I didn't understand too much about the brain at that time, you know, as much as what I do now.
So
I knew it wasn't good.
Yeah.
And made a quick decision. Got to start, you know, looking after my health and do some research on my own and find out what I can do to make myself, you know, heal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, manage and myself and get better.
Because you did. From memory, I think you told me that you had ongoing issues for weeks after that. You had problems with light. You had to be in a darkened room. You had some emotional issues as well after that bossy fight. Is that right?
Yeah. Emotional issues. I don't know if I was depressed or not. I just don't know. Suicidal thoughts? No. I just felt worthless.
Yeah.
But
you also there were other effects though, right? Like you had a bit of a ringing in your ears. You couldn't be in direct sunlight.
Yeah, bad headaches, and then repeating myself quite often. Mm. To those that were around me, my brother and my close mate and my coach. Yeah, I was repeating myself a lot.
Was there any follow up from the UFC after this?
No.
Did they, you know, pay for your medical bills, or did they try and give you some sort of treatment after that? Was there a medical program to check in after this had happened to you?
There was no program. They did fix my medical bills, my scans and my visits to the psychologist.
Oh, so you went to a psychologist afterwards?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. And
that was it?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. Yep.
So you went to see the psychologist. Was it because you were feeling depressed afterwards?
I went there because a doctor that was at the UFC, who I know, he's a local guy from Brisbane, from the combat sports area, community. He advised, okay, well, when you see this guy here, you know, this guy's pretty good, so you know, let's get your head sussed out, get some answers for you.
Was this a neurologist or a psychologist?
I think it was neurologist.
Neurologist, right.
Psychologist.
Yeah.
Neurologist, yeah, yeah.
Neurologist. Psychologist guy just sits down and says, tell me about your childhood.
Yeah, sorry.
So the UFC paid for these neurology sessions.
Yeah.
And what did the neurologist say to you when he saw those lesions in your brain?
He just pretty much said he told me to choose my next steps wisely.
Yeah.
Suggested me not to, guarantee anything that's going to give me further impacts to the head. Mm. And if I can be aware of having awareness of how I've been feeling and behaving and stuff like that, if anything comes up out of the blue, go back and see him.
Yeah.
And also for those close to me to be aware of any changes that may happen.
Now, those lesions in the brain, were they the effect of your fighting career? Was it potentially a residual effect from something that happened to you as a child? Did he tell you what those lesions were?
I think they can appear out of nowhere or something, or some people have more than others.
Mm.
Lesions can affect you, some don't. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I can't remember what he said.
Mm.
But, maybe those lesions have been there for a long time. Maybe they've accumulated over all those knocks and concussions that I've had.
Yeah.
I just don't know. But more or less, it's from those times that I've got those knocks. Yeah. Pretty obvious.
The thing about your career, though, is that it does seem to be that towards the end of your UFC career, your brain did change a little bit. You know, your chin did go and, you did seem to be like a different fighter. Is there any program in the UFC to check whether fighters' brains are changing throughout their career? Is there a baseline cognitive test? Do they do any scans before fights or is that not something that's part of the UFC?
No. So actually I did have a scan right before I signed up.
Right.
Yeah. So when I signed up with the UFC, I had to provide...
A brain scan.
A brain scan, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so what, did they show any lesions there or not?
I think so. There was a couple, but then there's changes comparing to that last one. Yeah,
right.
And that's what that neurologist brought up.
Yeah. No one's ever approached you about the legal exposure of the UFC and their role in your career or anything like that.
No.
That's never happened.
No.
I spoke to you a few years ago, and you were doing a bit of jiu-jitsu and you're doing some powerlifting. And you were talking about jiu-jitsu and lifting and stuff like that, elevating your mood, like this confidence issue had sort of resurfaced a little bit.
Yeah.
And you were trying to gain confidence again. You seem heaps happier now. Are you back competing again? Are you, what are you doing now putting in place where fighting used to be?
It's the hardest transition is when you, experience all these highs and then come out of your career, your sporting career, and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
There's no more highs anymore. So I'm like, fuck, what do I do?
Where's the money? Where's the hangers on?
Yeah. those highs, man, that thrill that I was, experiencing every few months just wasn't there anymore. And I was like,
also the cycle of life, leading up to training, fight, enjoying, partying, going down, building yourself back up again.
Yeah. So I was doing a few things like keeping active, training most days, and knew that I had to keep on training.
Yeah.
And then what did I do? I got into like lifting, weightlifting, and then competing in strongman competitions. So strongman in the last like I said 1 to 2 years, it's actually gained a bit of momentum now.
Yeah,
a lot more people are more familiar with it, and it's to be honest, it's something that I get a bit of a kick out of.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm not that good at it, but like when I started, I wasn't really good at it.
I don't know, man. The videos that I've seen, I mean, for your weight, like how much do you weigh? You probably weigh about 100 kilos.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd be pretty small for a strong man.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But they are weight divisions, thankfully.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big boy.
Yeah.
So my weight category, my weight division, I'm doing okay now. I'm doing quite good.
So give us some of the numbers. Are there raw things like, you know, bench press and deadlift and stuff like that?
My deadlift, so it's strongman's like I've got a multiple events that you have to compete in. And events like you might have to pick up a keg that weighs like 100 kilos, pick it up and race with it and quickly chuck it over like a height and then race back.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's a lot of static movement. It's quite different. But yeah, for example, like stone lifting or Atlas stone. A few people will be familiar with the Atlas stone. It's like a big round concrete ball.
Mm.
You pick it up off the ground, and then you got to put it over a certain height over a bar. And it's tricky, and it's a challenge. And it's something that I'll get a bit of a kick out of. Yeah. And,
mate, I get a kick out of watching your YouTube videos, your Facebook videos doing it. I'm just like, how heavy are they?
So my best is 190 kilos.
That's incredible. And the other thing is like, Have you dropped any on your foot yet?
Yeah, no, I've been lucky enough to.
It kind of looks like it's a concern.
But I guess I'm building up a bit more pride in myself because when I first started, again, like it was a challenge to me. I liked it, but I was at the bottom. Like me and my mate started out, and I couldn't. You know, I wasn't good. I was at the bottom.
Yeah,
I was coming last and everything. I was the weakest link. And then knowing, having that same mindset is what I had when I was a kid. Okay, well, what do we need to do? You know, I might take my mate, like, you know, maybe a week to go up 20 kilos. It's going to take me like 6 months to do the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah, put in the time and, yeah, I know what the process is.
Now, your martial arts career, there's positives and negatives. You know, there's been so many positives through your martial arts career. You know, the things that you've got the opportunity to do, the confidence that it's instilled upon you. There are negatives as well. You know, you have these lesions in your brain. You know that your brain has been affected because of your career. Now, you're not competing in mixed martial arts at all.
Mm.
Do you look back at it and do you see it as a net positive? It's something that was good for you in your life?
My martial arts career?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a big tool. It gave me lots of strength. If I wasn't involved in martial arts, I don't know what could have happened, you know. Could have taken like another path.
Yeah.
My dad could have taken another path. My family could have taken another path. I'm very happy that I got involved in combat sports and martial arts.
Mm.
It's, yeah. Put me in a really good place and many others in a really good place as well.
You had this athletic career. You've got this second athletic career doing doing strongman stuff. You know, at some point, as is the case with all of us, our bodies fall apart. Do you think you're going to be able to, you know, create the energy that's required to live a happy life when you're not doing athletics anymore?
Yeah, well, like I've been thinking about that. I'm 40 this year, and it's like I'm not going to go forever. I'm physically competing, but
not everybody can be Mark Hunt.
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Still, man, throwing
he's
him.
One in a million. He's still going, but I don't know. Like I don't know what I'm going to replace that thrill with.
Yeah.
Physically, I don't know how to change that over.
Yoga, man. You'd be
yoga.
You'd be one of those yoga instructors.
Yeah. Oh, who knows?
Just like, be I might down get about into 65 kilos and you'd be bending yourself up like a pretzel.
Yeah, find some type of challenge that works for my body.
Yeah.
So, it could be yoga, it could be running or something like marathons or whatever. Yeah. Yep. I'll just find something that my body's able to do.
Yeah.
So.
James, thanks so much for your time, mate. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. Appreciate it. That was James Tahuna, a somewhat forgotten giant of martial arts here in Australia and New Zealand. and a lovely and interesting guy. We hope you enjoyed the show and the chat. Please share the show and rate it on iTunes if you're enjoying it, and subscribe to make sure you catch new shows. We'll have another episode next week, and until then, follow your bliss.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.